Yeah, so a little plug for the conference first of all. I've printed out these lovely flyers for you, which had two sides, some information about the conference on the back, and I realised I've actually printed the front side on both of them, sort of double over, so hence you've got a slightly cut down version. It's a really wonderful chance to get away from the city and get out into some beautiful English countryside. And here are a few talks from speakers. Stephen Payne's going to be there. Roman Cluffery is there. And Maithri White, who's been organising the conference for the last 12 years.
Is that all right?
Come in, it'd be more interesting. That's the fastest that anyone's left. Although I'll digress, but once I teach engineering and I had a late swap with rooms with psychology. And some of my students sat in psychology for 3 weeks, and some of the psychologists sat in engineering for 3 weeks without realising it. Anyway, back to this. So this is a really good conference to come on. To meet people that are doing PhDs and masters in your kind of discipline, because I'm aware that as a Christian postgrad, you might not get people in your department that are Christians, or you might not even have thought how your studies reflect your faith or how your faith reflects your study. So it's a really good chance to get away. Joe has been for probably every conference. Did you miss one?
I missed one.
Okay. That's the worst one that you missed. And Joe does a band dance as well, so what more reason to come along than the dance on the Saturday night as well. It's in a beautiful location, Dovedale House, which is a little bit difficult to get to by train, but we're arranged lifts from Derby Station or Joe about transport. He's got some plans to get you up today. It's well worth going. There's an early bird discount for postgrads, which is £65 for the 3-day weekend, which is below cost price. The deadline for that passed last week. We've kept it open because I'm coming to this talk here, so it will be open for about the next 48 hours. So if you get in quick, you can get it for £65, and it's really well worth coming. Okay, advert over. So I'm going to talk to you this evening on this slightly strange title, Appropriate Technology, the Poetry of Science. I was telling Joe that if I put engineering in the title of any talk, no one ever comes. So hence, I've got a bit of poetry in here to balance out the technology. And you will see some poetry as we go through the talk. As I said, I'm an associate prof in the Faculty of Engineering at Nottingham. And I've been told this is intuitive. Okay, so first of all, I need to explain my title, Appropriate Technology, the Poetry of Science. And I need someone who's fluent in French to help me out here. Any fluent French speakers? Not at all.
I'll give it a go.
Go for it. So this is a quote from, this is James Watt looking particularly grumpy on the right-hand side of the screen here, with one of his inventions here, a double-acting steam engine. And during the Industrial Revolution in the UK, in France, they were chopping people's heads off with guillotine and all that kind of stuff. And Monsieur Bataille looks across the channel, and with a galax of the shrug, he looks at the inventions of James Watt, and he says,
"L'invention n'est-elle pas la poésie de la science?"
Fantastic. Round of applause. Which means, invention, isn't it the poetry of science? So my thesis tonight is that invention can be the poetry of science if it's appropriate. But I'd better give you some poetry. So here's a poem by an Ethiopian poet, economist, freethinker. He studied at the LSE in the 1950s in London. And this is one of his poems, Longing. It says, "The train hauled me out of London, out of the smoke, the smog, the grime, the filthy mix of soot and dust, while the train spun fog from the fabric of steam, clothing the land with its garment of blessings and punishments. Yizzy kataf, goes the powerful weaver. Isn't it amazing? Life's a miracle. Coal smoke set free through the power of coal." And when you look at the sort of amazing inventions that we've had, we're going to think about inventions in a bit, but think about Mengistu Lemo there, sitting on that steam train, seeing the smoke and the fog coming out of the funnels. You're going to get some quotes from some US presidents this evening in honour of Libby and Joe. So here we have Herbert Hoover, who was president during the 1930s. Yeah, and if you do a list of the sort of Google that the 10 worst US presidents, Herbert Hoover kind of usually fits in that list. He was a civil engineer, and he was really quite a good civil engineer, but he was not a very good politician. You know, it was politician through the Great Depression. But he was an engineer, and this is what he wrote in his memoirs about engineering. No, it's not the play. Okay, I'll have to read it to you. So what you should have now is the American National Anthem playing in the back. He says, engineering is a great profession. There is the satisfaction of watching a figment of the imagination emerge through the aid of science to a plan on paper. Then it moves to realisation in stone or metal or energy. Then it brings jobs and homes to men, not women. Then it elevates the standards of living and adds to the comforts of life. That is the engineer's high privilege. The great liability of the engineer compared to men of other professions are that his works are out in the open where all can see them. His acts, step by step, are in hard substance. He cannot bury his mistakes in the grave like the doctors. He cannot argue them into thin air like the judge, or blame the judge like the lawyers. He cannot, like the architects, cover his failures with trees and vines. He cannot, like the politicians, screen his shortcomings by blaming his opponents and hope that people will forget. The engineer simply cannot deny that he did it. If his works do not work, he is damned. So some pretty strong words about engineering there, and how it's much better than being a lawyer or an architect or a politician or a doctor. And when you look around at the sort of inventions that we've had, so here's some inventions from the field of transport, ocean-going lines, Model T forward there in 1907, the Wright brothers, first powered flight in 1903, and this beautiful steam engine here, we go back to steam engines, the Mallard, that in 1935 was doing 125 miles an hour up the West Coast main line. Mm. If only we could go that fast on Britain's railways today. Well, what about the inventions in the field of materials, nanotechnology, nanomachines there, some of the first plastics, Parkinson, smelting steel there, iron bridge over the River Severn, carbon fibre even used for things like bicycle frames. And all this technology has led commentators such as Radford, quotes of 35 years old now, nearly 40 years old. He says that the progress made in all these fields of technology have transformed human existence throughout, well, most of the world. And we might like to think what we mean by most of the world. Removing muscular effort and drudgery from the factory and the home. Second US president of the night, JFK here, his most famous quotation, and I'm going to misread it for you. The world is very different now, for man holds within his mortal hands the technology to destroy all forms of human poverty and the technology to destroy all forms of human life. Because all these technologies that we have, they can be used for good things, or they can be used for lots of good things. So on the flip side of this techno-optimism, this kind of concentration on the benefits of technology, moving the movement of muscular effort and drudgery from the factory in the home, here you have someone in the Great Depression sitting on a broken down steam engine, and the sign there says for sale. Someone who's very disillusioned with technology. This technology was, you know, it was going to improve his life and provide him with a living and a good income, but now the technology's broken down. He's disillusioned with it. So what have we done with our technology? What have we done with our money? Well, here's a clue, JFK looking on here. Here's the amount of money that we spend as a planet on overseas aid compared to the amount we spend on defence, on the military. So we spend about 1.25 trillion US dollars as a planet on the military. And we spend about 100 billion US dollars on overseas aid. And it's interesting that it's been in the news in the UK recently. The UK government have promised to give 0.7% of the GDP to overseas aid, but now they're saying actually, well, we could use some of that 0.7% to spend on security in these countries. Because obviously we're spending far too much on aid, we need to spend a bit more on the military to prop up the system. So here's a picture from the last time the G8 met in the UK, nearly 8 years ago now, and the G8 are meeting again in the UK next month, I think, in Belfast. But here you have Tony Blair with the hand of history on his shoulders once again, announcing a massive $50 billion for aid for Africa. Only this is money that some of which has been promised already, some of which has not materialised since the kind of promising. And some of it was kind of just lost in the accountancy process. Do you remember the Make Poverty History campaign? Whether you were in the UK then, where we all wore these bracelets with Make Poverty History? Well, Christian Aid, one of the charities involved, and Steve Tibbetts, says this is not going to make a difference. This is a drop in the ocean. When you look at $50 billion over 5 years, it's not really going to increase the amount of aid significantly at all. It's not going to make a difference. It's perhaps an interesting question to say that if we want to make poverty history, do we have to make affluence history as well? And that's quite challenging for people that have got money. We can kind of shout about people that haven't got money and that they should be getting more money, but where's it going to come from? So a quote here from the World Bank about poverty. And in 2001, they acknowledged that the percentage of people in poverty in sub-Saharan Africa rose from 41% to 46%. But if you take into account population growth again, the number of people in poverty living on less than a dollar a day almost doubled. And there's been some recent news about poverty declining in the world. So here's some fuzzy graphs here with the world population looking at the percentage of people in poverty. This is $1 a day, $1.25, $1.50, and so on. And you can see the graphs are coming down quite nicely. But if you exclude China, you see the position isn't so encouraging. The graphs are pretty flat. And again, if you factor in the population explosion that we've experienced during these two decades, the number of people living in abject poverty is increasing. So technology. Remember Radford's quote about it making a difference in the factory, in the home, and removing muscular effort and drudgery. Well, here's two photos. One's been taken from inside the pyramids in Egypt. I'm not too good on my Egyptology. Is that about 2000 BC? Looking for a historian. 2000 BC, around about there, 2000-3000 BC. Here's a guy in Uganda a few years ago. And they're both making bricks. And they're using pretty much the same process to make these bricks. Now that could be for one of two reasons. It's either that this is the most economical way to make bricks, or it could be that technology has just not reached this guy's life. See him making bricks with straw, it's kind of a nice kind of throwback to Egypt, Israelites crying out against their Egyptian slave masters when they're told to make bricks without straw. Well, at least this guy's got some straw in his. But he's using exactly the same process. So that's all kind of a big long intro, and I haven't mentioned what appropriate technology is. I don't know whether you've got any ideas about it. You're looking for me via a blank. Appropriate technology. Well, the best way to define appropriate technology is to tell you what inappropriate technology is. So if you want to go to sleep here now, or if you want to leave here, this is basically my conclusion slide halfway through. Which is that inappropriate technologies do not work, asterisk. And the asterisk is vitally important. Okay, so you need to do me a favour. Okay. If I move on from the head, sorry for bringing in.
Yeah.
If I move on from this slide without telling you about the asterisk, can you jump up and down and tell me to stop? Because I often do. Okay, so here I've got five pictures of technologies that I consider to be inappropriate, and you can kind of debate these with me if you like. So now it is audience participation time. Pick a picture.
Bottom right.
Do you recognise this one? Anyone recognise this?
It's the $100 laptop.
Yeah. Okay, so this is called One Laptop Per Child. Okay, so the aim is to make a laptop for $100 and to give it to people, give it to kids in developing countries. And basically, if you've got Wikipedia, who needs school teachers? Okay, Wikipedia and Google, and that'll basically, well, you know, it does for most PhD theses, doesn't it? So the laptops at the moment, they sell, or they're producing them for about $180 at the moment. So they're not quite reaching their target price. Why do I consider this to be inappropriate? I consider it to be inappropriate because the gross domestic product in some of these countries is almost equivalent to the price of these laptops. I've got two kids. Would I send my children to school carrying something that's worth my annual salary? I'm not going to tell you how much I own, but, you know, tens of thousands of pounds. Would I trust them to carry something like that to school? Would they be safe? Also, if you've tried to access the internet in some of these places, actually, it's not the computer that's the problem, it's getting internet access. Internet access can be really, really slow and extremely expensive in some of these places. And actually, this technology is kind of being superseded by smartphones. Technology is moving on at such a pace. Nigeria's education minister questions this approach. He says, what's the sense of introducing one laptop per child when children don't have seats to sit down and learn, when they don't have uniforms to go to school in, when they don't have basic facilities? The Indian Minister for Education has called the scheme pedagogically suspect, and the Education Secretary Sudeep Banerjee says the country needs classrooms and teachers more urgently than fancy tools. Guess where most of these laptops have been distributed? Which country?
Brazil.
Close. USA. Interesting. There was a scheme in Mali where the government were considering providing each child in school with a writing slate and a stylus. The scheme was rejected because it was too expensive. Where's the money going to come from for this? Okay, so that's number one. Pick a picture.
Potatoes.
Potatoes. Fantastic. You said potato, I said potato. Okay, this is a GM-modified potato called the Protato. So many people in India don't eat enough protein in their diet. So this is a scheme by the Indian government to introduce more protein into the diet by putting some protein genes into these GM-modified potatoes. Devinder Sharma says, what this country needs and has in abundance is pulses. Now, pulses contain 25% protein. The potato they talk about has 2.5% protein. Please tell me which one is better. You know, should we encourage people to eat more pulses, got 25% protein, or should we say, have a go at this GM-modified potato? I'm not particularly anti-GM, but it doesn't really make sense. Other environmental campaigners have questioned the whole kind of GM thing about putting these new genes into the mix, and said if it's the only way to get to a certain place, then sure, but if I can prevent weeds by mixed farming, it makes no sense to permanently introduce genes and toxins into my biodiversity and contamination of related crops. So, you know, there may be a place for GM, but I contend it's not to introduce protein into the diet of your average person in India. Do you want to pick another picture?
Put machines down by the
way. Okay, machines they were... I visited Ethiopia a few years ago, and this is a technical university, and a charity has given some really nice lathes to this university, only they're not being used. And they're not being used because they don't have metal to cut, they don't have a reliable electricity supply, they don't have the tools to change the cutting bits on the machines, And in the meantime, they're in dire need of things like office furniture. But it looks nice to have these nice shiny legs. What else should I do? This one is another one from Ethiopia. This is a hospital ward in Addis Ababa. And it's full up with donated medical equipment. The World Health Organization estimate that 50% of all medical donated items are either dangerous, broken, unsafe, past their use by date, or just generally not useful. So you have people shipping out-of-date medicines, you have people shipping things like machinery that's got for scrap only or for spares, so people can't have, they have an x-ray machine but they have no x-ray plates. Such is the bureaucracy in the Ethiopian Health Service, they're not allowed to throw any of this stuff away, so it takes up space in the wards. The tsunami, post-tsunami in Sri Lanka, they found amongst the donated medical supplies cancer medication that had gone past its date. Just a case of charity sending stuff, getting it out because it costs money to dump it. And my last one in the middle is a really interesting project. £2 million, 5-year funded project to produce a stove, cooking stove, that produces refrigeration and electricity for people cooking on wood fires. Really interesting in that they've chose to use English script on here, cool box, and also a nice 3-pin plug, which would be foreign to anyone from outside the UK. It's an interesting project, and it's a nice idea, but so it's a wood-fired stove, 4 kilowatt wood-fired, depending whether you're technical people or not, sums 4 kilowatts, 2 kilowatts goes into the electricity generating bit. How much electricity would you like out of your 2 kilowatts? That's going to be
2 kilowatts.
2 kilowatts. Oh, you're a power man, please. They don't quite get 2 kilowatts.
500 watts.
Lower than that.
100 watts.
Lower than 100 watts. At the moment, they get 25 watts. 2 kilowatts going in. The latest prototype that I saw actually working in almost outside of lab condition was generating a massive 5 watts. Scary inefficient. Oh, asterisk. Thank you. Okay, so inappropriate technologies do not work. Asterisk, and the asterisk is that all of these projects have been funded. So they work really well if you're going to get funding out of a donor, because they sound really nice when you kind of put a positive spin on them. You know, sending stuff to Ethiopia and medical equipment sounds like a really good idea. Providing children with computers, etc., etc. Okay, so that's the downs, this is the lowest point of the talk. Okay, so then hopefully it's going to get a little bit more cheery. So what do I mean by appropriate technology? This is Fritz Schumacher, who founded the Intermediate Technology Development Group, now known as Practical Action, which is a wonderful charity up in Coventry. And in the 1960s, 1970s, he was talking about technology being flexible, regionally applicable, and sustainable, before the sustainable was such a buzzword as it is today. My friend Mengistu Lemwe here, he says, what's the use for a country like ours, in his case Ethiopia, of engineers that have all this technical knowledge, but who are ignorant of the social purpose of their activities? I was talking to Joe beforehand about the need for education to be rounded, even at graduate level. You know, what are you doing with your degree that, you know, can you step outside of your specific speciality and think, actually, what's the social purpose of society, this technology, or these ideas, or this thesis is going to address? And you have Gandhi there talking about interdependence rather than self-sufficiency. So here's a kind of checklist for what makes something appropriate. It's going to be cheap, use local materials, use local skills. The idea is that if it breaks down, it can be fixed. So an example from the UK is that when I first learned to drive a car, and I bought these old banger cars, when they went wrong, you used to lift the bonnet up, and you could see which bit had gone wrong, and you could have a go at fixing it. You could do things like change spark plugs, and change oil filters, and replace bits, Now if you lift up the car bonnet when your car's gone wrong, you see this kind of yellow plastic cover, and it says in big letters, do not touch, unless you have these specialised tools. Unless you have something to interrogate the onboard computer that kind of will tell you what's going on with the car. And basically, you know, it should just have a phone number or something that you should just ring up and call out, because you have no chance of fixing this car. And the same is true of technology the world over. So in the 1970s, the UK were very good at sending tractors out to Africa and saying, well, if you plough more land, you could grow more food. And so tractors would be sent out and they'd start to plough the ground, and they'd be fine until something broke down, and then it was realised that no one could fix them, and the spare parts were in Essex. And it's a long way to Essex. So some examples of appropriate technologies, or technologies that I consider to be more appropriate than the ones that we've been looking at before. Do you want to pick pictures, or do you want me to go through this? Pick a picture.
Bike in the air.
Fantastic. It's a bike in the air. This is a guy called William Kamkwamba, who's from Malawi. And he went to school until he was 14, and then his parents couldn't pay the school fees anymore. But he loved reading. Didn't have a laptop. He had a library. So he went to the library, and he got a book out on windmills. And he decided he wanted to build a windmill. And he told all his friends and family that he was doing something magic. Because he said if he told them he was building a windmill, they would kind of laugh at him, but magic was alright. So he built himself a windmill, built himself a wind turbine with bits from the dump, old pipes that he flattened out. And his windmill produces 14 watts of electricity. It's extremely inefficient, but he made it. He says, if you want to make it, all you have to do is try. And he's got a book out called The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. Really interesting story. Take me a picture.
Bottom right.
Okay, this is it's like a solar cooker. You have solar cookers? This is the idea that you can cook with the rays of the sun. Good for some situations, not good for others. The lady here is using it to purify water, which is a really excellent way of using a solar cooker. You just leave your bottle of water in there, it's going to get heated up, it's going to kill all the pathogens in it. Your pan of water, rather than the bottle, it's going to melt the plastic. So solar cookers, good sometimes, not so good a number of occasions. Yeah. Anything else? Where do we want to go? Oxford bicycle. Bicycle, the ultimate appropriate technology. How many of you cycle? Yeah, most of you. If your bike breaks down, how many of you can fix your bike? Well, you can have a go.
I can't remember that time.
You can have a go. You can change. Have you changed the puncture? Fixed the puncture on the bike? No. Some of you need a bit of practical engineering. But you can have a go with a bicycle if it breaks. What else have I got? Interesting idea from India. This is a Tata Nano car. 600cc engine. Really sort of clunky design, sheet steel kind of doors and things. No airbag, because if you've ever driven in India, no one uses a seatbelt. So why would you put an airbag on the car? They don't ever put the seatbelt on. You know, really basic technology. Manual windows, you have to wind down the windows. You remember cars like that? But really basic. Cut to the minimum. Another two. Top left, mobile phone repair shop. Again in India. The idea of repairing a mobile phone. You know, I got this about 2.5 years ago, and I use about 1% of the functions on here. I am such a technophobe. You know, I've used the camera a few times, I've never used the video. There's other stuff on here that just scares me. But, you know, when this, my contract's up, and, you know, what I should be doing is ringing up the phone company and saying, oh, what deal have you got for me for a new phone with all these kind of even more technology sort of stuff on it. But actually, I just need this to make phone calls. It'd be really nice if it didn't have email on, then I wouldn't get emails from students at midnight. And the last one here, this is how to do refrigeration. Two ceramic pots, you put some wet sand in the middle, and as the sun heats up the sand with the water, water evaporates and generates some cooling. Some really basic physics, but a nice way of doing refrigeration if you haven't got a plug-in fridge. I'm conscious I haven't talked about my Christian faith or about how my faith kind of relates to all of this. I'm a volunteer with a charity called Tear Fund, which is nothing to do with crying. It's the Evangelical Alliance Relief Fund. And for years I used to go around giving talks to Tear Fund. And I would give my talk and I would be shaking hands at the back of the church or the organisation. And I remember two occasions very specifically when little old ladies came up to me and said things like, "Oh, you must notice it's very different when you come back to the UK from being overseas or wherever." And the truth is that I hadn't gone overseas with Tear Fund at all. I was just the front man telling the story. So I kind of scratched my head about 10 years ago and thought, actually, what can I do that relates my 9-to-5 job to my interests in the evening, to my Christian faith? What is there about what I've got that I can use for God? And what I've got is loads of undergraduates who need projects. So I wrote to Tear Fund and we put a little problems wanted advert in one of their newsletters that goes around the world. And it went a bit like this. If you have an engineering problem, drop me a line and I'll see what I can do about it. And as a result, I've had hundreds and hundreds of letters, emails from all around the world. One of my secretaries collects stamps and she has stamps now from countries that she didn't know even existed. And I'm going to show you some of the stories of the problems that we've tackled. I'm also involved with Engineers Without Borders. You've heard of this organisation? Really interesting bunch. One of these organisations is smiling. You heard about them?
Well, it's Engineers Without Borders UK.
Yeah. It is Engineers. Well, so the story is that there is an Engineers Without Borders based in the USA. And if you don't say Engineers Without Borders UK, they sue. and they do different stuff, so I have to be very careful and say Engineers Without Borders UK. There are other Engineers Without Borders in different countries. It's one of these organisations that isn't specifically Christian, but a lot of the people involved with it, when you get to know them, somehow, hey, they're Christians. It's kind of interesting. And they specialise in sending students for 6-8 weeks in the summer or maybe a year placement, doing engineering in really interesting places. And I've got a few stories to tell from them as well. So this was the first problem that we responded to. It was a letter that came from Soroti in northern Uganda. It was a church group, and the problem in their village was that it was very high unemployment. They'd been in a time of conflict and war, and they'd lost all their cattle. People didn't have jobs, and there was also no baker in the village. So the church wanted to be really practical and it wanted to start up little businesses to employ people, to give them some dignity so they could earn some money. And so one of the businesses they wanted to start up was bakers. And the request to me was, can you build me an oven? I said, yeah, gas or electric. I said, no, wood-fired oven. And we'd like to bake about 300 little loaves of bread a day. And it's going to look like it's movable. It can't be a brick oven because we're going to rent somewhere, and if our landlord sees a nice brick oven, he'll come along and double our rent. So it's got to at least look like we can move it. So here's four of my finest engineers, final year MN students, with their design. Sheet steel, and we use sand as insulating material between the layers. So the idea is if you want to move, you pull the plug out, the sand drains out, you lift you up and shut you. I show this picture for two reasons. One is that you can see that we take safety very seriously, a fire extinguisher up there. And the other one is you see the paint peeling on that building. That was before we lit the fire, okay, so it had nothing to do with us. And there's Richard with one of the first things he's ever cooked. Warburton's provided the bread, the flour for the bread free of charge. We had some delicious bread out of it. The idea of the project was to send a set of drawings to Uganda so it could be made locally. To give you an example of why it was appropriate, one thing we did was not to use any welding, we used nuts and bolts. So the design had 400 nuts and bolts in it, which if you were marking it as a UK project, you'd go really bad, welder. But if you're making it somewhere that hasn't got welding facilities, 400 nuts and bolts are really good. Original idea was to send a set of drawings to Sarotti to have it made there. At the end, we decided to send something as a prototype, so we shipped it out. And there it is, baking bread in Sarotti. And we made some mistakes, and we learned quite a lot from that initial project. This video isn't going to run with sound, so I'm going to show you some pictures instead. I talked about donating medical equipment, particularly wheelchairs. If you're aware of the NHS in the UK, they're not awash with money. And anything that is thrown away by the NHS in the UK is rubbish, okay, and is fit for the skin. So if anyone's talking to you about sending wheelchairs out from old wheelchairs from UK hospitals, tell them not to bother. And if you've ever been to anywhere like Ethiopia and you've seen the roads, a UK-style wheelchair is not going to survive 5 minutes outside of a nice, smoothly polished floor on a hospital wheel, hospital ward. So we started designing an appropriate technology wheelchair, and the key was to use mountain bike wheels, because if your mountain bike wheel gets punctured or your wheel gets buckled, there's people all around the world that can fix it, apart from in Oxford, where you can take it from. Obviously, they haven't got your hands to it. So that was the design, and we've had various interests in that. We kind of hit a bit of a point at the end where we said, do we want to mass produce this, or do we want to just give the design out for free? How do we take this forward? So it's a kind of a bit of a crossroads as to how we take this one forwards. There's a lovely video on YouTube. If you type in Africa wheelchair, then you see it in action.
So what are the units?
Okay, so this is, if you're getting through really tough terrain, there's some gearing on here, so we can actually lever it forwards like this. It's on a ratchet, so you can get some extra torque to go through really rough ground. Or you can just wheel along with the mountain bike tires, if you like. I started to travel a little bit more. These are my kind of slides from Ethiopia a few years ago. And a lot of my research now is on cooking stoves. So here I'm looking at a cooking stove, more about that later. And it really struck me the differences between town and country in Ethiopia. So here, a little girl on the top right here is in the centre of Addis. And the top left here was on the hills outside of Addis Ababa. In sort of traditional dress. Deforestation is a big issue. You have the women here with the donkeys taking wood down into Addis Ababa to be sold. Their boss, who was a man, was walking with them, and his hands were completely empty. He didn't stop. So yeah, cook stoves, cookery lessons. So in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia and Eritrea as well, they eat this flatbed bread called injera. Yeah, injera, yeah. With some dora wort, chicken stew, very nice, yeah. You just tear a bit off, sort of fermented,
delicious,
yeasty thing, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they cook it on a magogo, which is that stove at the top left. But it's really inefficient in terms of firewood use, maybe 10-15% efficient. And I went to visit an organisation there that was trying to make more efficient stoves. And they had a group come over from the US, and they said, we'll design you a more efficient stove. And this is their more efficient stove. It's made of concrete. Concrete's quite expensive. Tested in the labs. Uses far less firewood. So they ring up the guys in Addis, we've got this really nice stove for you. Oh, come over and test it. So they take it over to Addis, and they do their pan boiling test. You boil a pan of water, which is the standard way you test the stove efficiency, and sure enough, it uses a lot less wood, because that's the standard test you do. So the guys in Addis are really excited, and they say, what about cooking injera? How does it cook injera? Sorry. Injera, you know, the food you cook on. Oh, we've never done that. We've just done the pan boiling test, because that's the standard way you test efficiency. So they put the hot plate on, pour the batter on, it's a bit like cooking a pancake. And it burns in the middle, it doesn't cook on the outside, because the heat distribution is entirely wrong. Much more efficient, but you can't cook food on it. Another stove that I saw over there is this one called the Clean Cook Stove. It's a liquid fuel stove, methanol burning stove, like a camping stove developed in Sweden. And the locals there just laughed at this stove. They said, how can we cook injera on this? It's the wrong shape. It's like trying to sell a stove to Italians that you can't cook pizza on. It's a no-go. So here's one of my PhD students who's graduated now. He's dressed as a Thunderbird's puppet for reasons that I'll maybe tell you later. But he wrote to me, he was doing 2 years voluntary service overseas in Eritrea, and he wrote to me and he said, the girls aren't coming to school because they're collecting firewood all the time. If I can make a more efficient stove that works, maybe they'll come to school. So he came over and did a PhD with me for 3 years, and he did some combustion modelling, that's the right hand side here. He did some really exciting burning bits of wood experiments. So here you have a tower of bits of wood stacked, and you set light to it, and you measure how long it takes to burn. You know Jenga, the game?
Mm. Yeah.
This is hardcore Jenga. Because it's on fire. And we looked at traditional cooking stoves, and we did some testing in the labs. But we realised that we needed someone who knew how to cook Enduro. And Hugh noticed that one of the cleaning ladies was from Eritrea. So he got talking to this lady, and he said, could you come in and help with our research? She said, yeah, okay, I'd love to. Cook some Enduro for us. And have you got any friends? Oh yeah, I know some. And we got some cleaning staff and some asylum seekers as well to come in and help with the research project to show us how to cook Enduro and to see how much wood they use on the new design of stone. And I think it's the only university research project that uses cleaning staff that I'm aware of. How are we doing for time? I'll skip through this one a bit. So this is another stove project. This is Ellie, one of my undergraduates, who went to India with Engineers Without Borders. And again, another cooking stove project. She did some sort of stove efficiency work, talked to women about what they valued in a cook stove. So rather than just being an engineer and saying it's all about efficiency, the women were talking about how long is it going to last, this stove? Will I be able to use my old pots and pans on this stove, or will I need to buy new cookware? Is it easy to clean? Is it easy to light? This is one of the stoves that Ellie was looking at. It was produced by an Indian manufacturing company there. She's talking to the ladies about cooking on this stove. And it looks really nice and shiny, but then actually if you use it for a bit, it gets really dirty, and it's really hard to clean. So Ellie came back to the UK, and for her final year project, group project, she wanted to design a better stove. So she worked with a team of 4 undergrads, and they did some computational fluid dynamics, they did some thermal imaging, they did all this fancy design, but they also took into account those preferences of the Indian ladies. And this is the design of the stove. It's a 2-pan stove. Whenever I'm asking people about cooking, the first thing I ask is, what food are you cooking? So most of the meals were sort of rice and dals, and you can fry off on the bottom pan there, and you can leave the rice to steam on the top pan. And 1 week, sort of near the end of the project, the group came in, I see them most weeks, and they said, oh, we've got this prototype stove. I said, oh, does it work? Yeah, it works really well. Can you cook food on it? Yeah, we can cook food on it. So we have our weekly sort of tasks that I set them. So I said, okay, your task for next week is that I want you for 1 week to cook all your food on a wood-burning stove. And they learned more in that week than they ever did in any of my lectures. There's the stove prototype. Ellie and Greg, after they finished, they graduated, they went back to Pondicherry to test the stove out. There's one of the ladies giving it some testing for us. And the first bit of feedback we got was, they don't like the other. It's good job we only made one. And there's a kind of celebration picture here. So more stories of my students. This is Joel Cheney. He's one of my post-grads. He's just finished. He's got a job up in Edinburgh, a postdoc. And he looked at briquetting, turning agricultural waste into fuel as a replacement for firewood. He went over to Ghana. And then some other students wanted to take this idea to Kenya, to Mombasa. And rather than sending them with a kind of solution, we sent them with a really rough idea of how to make briquettes. And the easiest way to do it is to squidge it all up and press it with your hands. Okay. So that's what they're doing on the top left. And we sent them over a really basic press, but we said, actually, this press isn't very good. And when they got to Mombasa, one of the locals said, well, we've got a carpenter. He can make us a better press than this. So the carpenter gets involved and designs a better press. And one of the carpenters making the press, he says, could you use some sawdust? He says, yeah, could we use some sawdust? So sawdust starts getting mixed into these briquettes as well. And they've been making them for a while now, and they're supporting an orphanage with some of the proceeds from making and selling these projects. A couple of other stories, Engineers Without Borders. This is Aaron Eales. He wasn't very politically correct in those days. He was talking about the Third World, which is a kind of banned phrase for my students. He went off to Sri Lanka, looked at how they were making bike frames and was kind of looking at them welding in flip-flops and things. He looked at a micro-hydra scheme and it's all very technical. Basically, he's got a stopwatch in a bucket here, and he's timing how long it takes to fill up the bucket to measure the flow of water through that turbine. Took it apart and had a look at it with the local engineers as well. But the reason for telling you about Aaron is that when he came back to the UK, this experience really changed his life. And he now runs a little company called V3 Power that makes wind turbines. He's installed them in Pakistan and the Philippines, lots in the UK as well. And he's not a millionaire. He's still a bit of a kind of, and it's being recorded, he's a bit of a hippie character, and I think he'd kind of like the tag of being a bit of a hippie. But he loves what he's doing, because that kind of fits in with his drive for sustainable development and his ideas of making a difference. And my last story, this is Rob Quayle. Again, another EWB placement. He went to Ecuador to look at cook stoves. And you can see here the ladies cooking inside the house on an open fire, which is pretty typical. And the walls and ceiling of the house are just blackened with soot. And the food there is guinea pig and sweet potato. So Rob works with the villagers, and he sort of talks to them about making stoves, makes some with them. You know, can we get any steel pipe for chimneys? No. Okay, can we get flat sheets of metal that we can bend around? Yes. How much do they cost? Where can we get them from? Works with them to make an appropriate stove for their needs. After a couple of weeks, students being students, Rob and his friends decide to take a bit of a holiday and go trekking. Okay, up into the Andes, because, you know, we've not talked. When Rob goes away, the men of the village get together and they have a conversation that goes a bit like this. English students, come here and tell us how to make stoves. We can do better than that. So when Rob comes back after 2 weeks away, he finds that the villagers have made 5 stoves of their own design. Well, they've kind of taken Rob's design and they've made the stove a little bit higher so it's easier to cook on, a bit narrower so it fits in the house. And here's Don Matalu with Don Matalu's stove. And if his stove breaks, Don Matalu can fix it. It's not some kind of stainless steel thing that's been parachuted in as if it's arrived from outer space. It's a stove that he knows how it works. He knows how it should be working. And he knows how to repair it. And I don't know what the spaghetti bolognese was made of. So any academic that talks to you about their research will tell you that you need more funding and more kind of input into this area of appropriate technology. Particularly, we need engineers to talk to social scientists more. I've just got a nice grant looking at cook stoves in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, particularly looking at Southern Africa. And I'm pleased to say there's no designing new stoves. It's all about looking at why people aren't using existing technologies, because in many cases there's a technology that exists to solve a lot of these problems. It's just understanding why it's not being applied and why it's not being used. So we need more dissemination of what works as well. The ethical elements of these projects have really motivated and challenged the students. They've been really rewarding. My head of department's happy because we generate some good news stories from this. But most importantly for me, it changes lives, particularly the people like Aaron who've been changed by serving these communities. So my acknowledgement slide, thanks to Tier Fund Engineers Without Borders for providing some of the ideas for projects. E.ON provided some of the funding for the travel, so please go home and turn on all your lights. Thanks, I'll take questions if you've got them.
Intermediate technology,
yeah.
And you obviously use the word appropriate. Can you say something slightly more about how those two things
They're interchangeable. I mean, the organisation that Schumacher set up was the Intermediate Technology Development Group, and the phrases intermediate and appropriate seem to be used interchangeably. I think intermediate kind of fell out of favour a little bit because it was seen as a bit of sort of second-class technology. And really, appropriate shouldn't be just for the developing world. It should be what it says, appropriate to that location. So it should be kind of core engineering design. So for example, we've done some work with a community in the Outer Hebrides, and we've looked at appropriate solutions for them, not because they're some backward, you know, sort of impoverished community, but because of their situation and their remoteness and their specific geographic kind of challenges. We're looking at technologies that fit what we do. So maybe appropriate is a bit more broad and a little bit more politically correct than intermediate.
To universities in these countries getting involved, and is it possible to, is one way of taking schools to get them taking these projects for themselves?
Yeah, so the question about universities in some of these countries getting involved. Part of the challenge for me is when people ask me to do projects is why is it better doing it in Nottingham than doing it in country? We've certainly been working with Addis Ababa University in Ethiopia on a number of projects. We've kind of been doing stuff that perhaps they can't do in country. So we've done some of the computer modelling. We've relied on doing the field testing in Addis. The project I've got with Southern Africa has got a university in Zambia and Malawi and South Africa involved as well. So I think it's vital that we do get universities in some of the organisation and places where these technologies get rolled out to involved. But it's just kind of working out when it's better to do something here and when it's better to do something elsewhere. So yeah, it's a good point.
And getting them, I guess, to ask the same questions and
be different. Yeah, I mean, you can have this kind of tension. I heard a talk, really interesting one, a few years ago by a Muslim scientist who was really berating Islamic universities and saying that often they kind of run after the sort of nanotechnology and they're really kind of trying to catch up with what everyone else is doing rather than addressing kind of in-country needs. So there's been quite a debate recently about, you know, India having a space program and yet having massive challenges in country. And I think it's really hard, you know, because I think it's wrong for us to dictate what people spend their money on. But at the same time, it's really quite strange that ignoring local problems to kind of run after high profile stuff.
It's a bit of a hot issue, but you mentioned about one of the products whether to go forward with patenting it or manufacturing it.
Yeah.
Now, with drugs, for instance, that's probably the biggest issue where drug companies say we need to patent this because we need to make money, but at the same time, by patenting it, what happens is it inhibits people from actually buying it.
Yeah, so Schumacher's sort of vision of appropriate technology was one without patents, without protecting your IPR. And some of my engineering colleagues really kind of raised their eyebrows at that and said, well, actually, how are we going to make our money? And I guess you kind of go back to thinking actually being first to market is a great advantage. Yeah, I think for drug companies it's tough. I mean, if you have put all these years of development into something, then effectively the technology being given away for free is perhaps unrealistic.
So, what about the option of perhaps government funding, maybe? Isn't that possibility?
So another thing is actually who's funding projects, and do you expect drug companies to be funding stuff that's just profitable or stuff that's going to make a difference? So. I think there's been a lot of talk about the limited funding that's going into malaria treatments, for example, because there's no money in it, essentially. There's more money in creating a cure for baldness. Because old middle class people have got more money than people suffering from malaria. So maybe there's a kind of driver there for governments to fill the gap, to say actually this is where the money needs to go. I know there's kind of quite a tension between the UK and the US, in that particularly in engineering, in the UK, it's very hard to get funding for anything that isn't kind of got a commercial outcome. Whereas I think in the US it's completely the opposite, in that if something is commercial, there's the expectation it will be funded by private companies. So, yeah, different priorities.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the stories and sort of the pictures of the stoves and all that kind of thing. I guess it left me wishing I had more appropriate technologies around my house so that I could fix things. there's a point of starting to fiddle with something that I guess I need to call an electrician or a phone call.
Yeah.
It's just sort of beyond the capacity of somebody who's not professionally trained. Just more of a comment.
I think it's technologies conspired against you, you know, the number of things that you can't take apart and fix anymore. Mm. And there's a bit of a counterculture to kind of say we want stuff that we can fix. And you know, design for repair is kind of becoming a little bit on the agenda, but it's really tough because people want to sell you a new thing when your thing breaks down, because they make more money off you like that.
Yeah, are there areas where there's talk of developing more repairable?
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting ones I've heard about is washing machines, in that rather than selling you a new cheap and nasty washing machine every few years, there's a kind of school, there's a company setting up that will hire you out a washing machine, and you know, then if it breaks down, it's the onus is on them to fix it. So again, I talk about the when I talk about sustainability. If you think about the companies that sell you electricity and gas, DR or E.ON, for example, they've got no kind of benefits if you're behaving sustainably, because you're going to use less of their product and you're going to pay less to them. So my dream is, and if there's any economists, tell me why this is a non-goer, but why not? How about if I had had a contract with my energy supplier that said they will keep my house at given temperature during the year? And that might be by insulating my loft, it might be by fitting me with double glazing, it might be by changing my boiler, but having more of a service contract that's kind of a long-term contract, so that the benefits from all these things are going to be felt by the person supplying me with the electricity, because then they'd have to supply me with less. And they'd make their money that way, rather than making their money by supplying me with more of, because I'm being efficient. That's my dream.
Yeah, I guess I had a question that sort of very much tags along with Rob's, but how do you see, or do you see, these ideas of appropriate technology being applied in, say, Oxford or Nottingham?
I think, I mean, the bicycle is a great example for places like Oxford, isn't it? Where, you know, the last time I came here and called a cab, I was trying to get from the station to one of the colleges further out, and after 10 minutes of sitting in the cab, I just got out of the cab and walked because it was quicker. And, you know, I think as we see the breakdown of some of the infrastructure systems that we've relied on for a long time, there's a kind of need to think more radical solutions. Mm-hmm. So things like, you know, big cities investing in things like cycle hire schemes as well, which, you know, wouldn't have been on the agenda maybe 5-10 years ago, but suddenly it kind of, actually it's a better way around things. So yeah, I think there's some clever technologies to be done.
Mm.
And not necessarily new technologies, but actually going back to kind of existing ones, but using them differently.
Mm.
Yeah. It seems like in that side of the case studies of inappropriate technologies and then appropriate technologies had to do with how much the technology is sort of aware of the environment in which it's being introduced to.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if this even falls under sort of engineering or this bigger political social issue. If you have any thoughts on the sort of intrinsic problem, well, how do we set up sort of electricity for a country like Ethiopia eventually? And is that something I feel like in your field or in the organizations you work with, you know, be aspired to, or that's just sort of beyond sort of
Yeah, I think the challenge of engineering, and particularly applying for funding, is that you kind of need to have the solution before you talk about the problem. So the electricity generating stove had to go in with, this is what we're going to do at the start, before they actually worked out how much electricity people would need, or actually, you know, I'm a mechanical engineer, and actually I've kind of balked at the idea of electricity, because actually no one wants electricity. What they want is lighting and heating, and to be able to watch their telly. And some of that is going to be provided by electricity, but it's not the only solution. So, you know, for example, listening to the radio, you know, you have the clockwork wind up radio, so actually hooking up everyone to a grid is not necessarily the only way to do some of those things. Whereas, you know, thinking about electricity being more of a carrier than the solution for some of these kind of solutions is kind of important, I think. So not to kind of rule out everything and saying we're going to go with this technology, which is tends to be the way engineers kind of look at stuff. They say, this is a solution, where are we going to make this fit? So the little kind of camping stove was a classic in that it's a stove that's been designed in Sweden for the camping market, and then someone's gone, oh, this would work well in Africa, wouldn't it? Well, no, it wouldn't, because it's not been designed for that. Trying to make it fit just isn't going to work. Yeah, Joe.
30 or 40 years ago, I heard of a project called A Car for Africa.
Yeah.
Which, if I remember, it had 4x4 timber frame rather than metal, which could be repaired locally easily after a crash.
Yep.
And then, of course, the mechanics of it were the traditional things that people who know a little bit about cars can work with. Did anything ever come of that?
No, and I think economies of scale kind of killed it, and cheaper imports, and also people wanting what we've got. And you know, this I think sometimes, you know, looking at it, it's very easy to design stuff for people that they don't actually want. And so there needs to be this kind of desire from the bottom, really. Car from Africa is a really interesting one. I've heard debates about that. And actually, if you're designing a car for Africa, it has to be a lot more robust than the car for the UK. So it's necessarily going to cost more money. And directly it costs more money. Well, who's going to buy these things? So a car for Africa is probably the 4x4 where it's the Toyota to pick up, isn't it? It's the, you know, really robust solution. So.
Yeah, but the frame was 4x4 timbers. And yeah. 4 inches by 4 inches. Not a 4x4 car. Contemporary.
Yeah. And, you know, it comes around. I mean, people are looking at automotive companies looking at sort of natural fiber products for car bodies and things in the UK.
And another question. Are you in contact with any other engineering departments where similar things have been done?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few in the UK. Cambridge are quite active. Liverpool, Warwick, there's a few kind of people around. What I tend to do is try not to get labelled as a kind of developing world engineer. So when I approach colleagues, the guy that sort of co-supervised one of the stove projects, I went up to him and said, oh, I've got this thermodynamics problem. Oh, yeah, I do thermodynamics. Right, can you help supervise the student? Oh, by the way, it's a stove for Eritrea. Mm. Whereas actually, if I'd gone up to him and said, I've got this Eritrean project, he'd have gone, don't know anything about that. Don't know anything about developing world stuff. So I tend to try and sell problems to my fellow engineers as being, this is your area of expertise, and I really need you to help me out with this, because this is something you know about. And all other ways.
Do you have another question? You talked about wanting to do something that connected sort of more with your faith, and that leading you to get involved in things like Engineers Without Borders and sort of engage in these social issues, social problem solving kind of stuff. And I just wondered if you'd reflected at all if there are ways in which sort of these ideas about appropriate technology and durability and simplicity also sort of, you saw those as resonating with aspects of your faith as well, so not just sort of the like,
yeah,
we're solving a problem here, but also sort of these ideas about the type the type of solutions we're creating.
I've written things about, you know, technology in the Bible is an interesting case study, and actually the projects, when you think about technology in the Old Testament, certainly seem to be very kind of big and grand. So you have, you know, construction of the temple, or you have kind of, if you want a literal kind of Noah's Ark, or, you know, huge kind of scale projects. But actually, when you look at, and if you look at things like Nehemiah building the walls of Jerusalem, you have, okay, this is a really big project, but Nehemiah is a really good example because each family had their own bit to rebuild. So there's this kind of, okay, this is a big project, but everyone has their bit to do and has their skill to bring to it. So there's kind of room for everyone to fit into it. So I kind of like the idea of this kind of fitting in the Christian view of technology as well.
All right, well, I think if that's all our questions, we'll just thank Mike again for a great talk.